Let me first outline the broader context. Generally speaking, my current research focuses on late medieval astrologers from a very specific and, as I like to believe, innovative point of view. You are certainly all aware, and I only want to remind you of this very briefly, that astrology and astrologers are usually not considered to constitute a serious subject of historical inquiry, at least not in mainstream medieval history, particularly in Germany. This observation is at once easy to confirm and quite puzzling. Let me illustrate this with an autobiographical example. When I was still working on my habilitation project on images of Europe in the Middle Ages, some colleagues with whom I talked about my work might have been a bit bored, but they did not fundamentally doubt the relevance and legitimacy of the subject. Having finished my habilitation and published a book that resulted from this work, I developed a new project and made the opposite experience. I told people that I was interested in late medieval astrologers, and quite a considerable number of my interlocutors reacted quite strangely, implying that this was neither serious nor important work. Now, the interesting thing is that even the most superficial glance at medieval sources reveals how unfitting these reactions actually are. In fact, one would probably never even dream of working on the notion and idea of Europe in medieval texts and images if we were not interested in this subject from our modern point of view. While we consider Europe to be important nowadays and are thus interested in possible forerunners of something that resembles a European conscience, the notion does not occupy an exceedingly prominent place in medieval sources. Of course, I argue in my book that Europe was much more present, more important, and much more multifaceted in medieval texts than was usually held in mainstream medieval studies. But truth be told, Europe still can't rival with Christianity, regional identities, and further categories of collective organization and identification. So while the pertinence of my book-length work could legitimately be debated quite controversially, the opposite is the case for astrology and astrologers. Pick a random chronicle that was redacted between the 13th and 15th centuries in Latin Europe, and chances are that you find at least one astrologer. Now, in spite of this quite remarkable presence of individuals whose social origins and whose rank would in fact hardly make them worthy to be included in historiographical works, historians have mostly tended to ignore them or to explain them and their presence away by interpreting them as a collateral phenomenon of late medieval people's superstition. This is not to say that they were entirely ignored. In the late 19th century, cultural historians granted them some space in their works, and in the early 20th century, important and still useful analyses have been made and published by scholars influenced by Abbé Warburg and his circle. More recently, historical research on astrology has gathered momentum, you all know this, especially since the 1990s. The critical studies and editions that have been published by scholars like Charles Burnett, Hilary Carey, John North, Jean-Baptiste Boudet, Eugenio Garin, but also more recently by Darren Hayton, Monica Azzolini, David Just and others, provide vital insights and furnish extremely valuable material, without which I couldn't even dream of approaching my own research question. I expressly want to underline how indebted I am to all these colleagues and forerunners, and I just realized that I drew at least part of a list of all the people who came by here in Erlangen probably during the last years with David Just, so I won't dig any deeper into that. At the same time, I would like to claim that my own approach still differs from the majority of the existing works, since most of these important and erudite studies focus either on questions concerning the history of science, including internal debates between practitioners of astrology, or on the interferences between astrology and theology as represented by the dogma of the institutionalized church. So in the end, many contributions try to demonstrate that astrology and astrologers did in fact play an important role in late medieval culture. With my own work, I do not seek to further add to this demonstration, which, by the way, did not yet lead to the inclusion of the subject in more mainstream syntheses. You only have to open the most recent edition of the Cambridge Medieval History of the German Gebhardt in order to discover that the classical objects of political, social, and economic history still get the lion's share, while astrologers are virtually invisible. Nevertheless, and deplorable as the situation might be, my own work builds on the foundations that have been provided by the scholars I just mentioned. So let's just accept for the moment, and for the sake of the argument, that astrologers did occupy an important and vital role for late medieval cultures and societies in a plethora of contexts. From the 13th century onwards, they appear more prominently as close and probably influential advisors of kings and princes. Somewhat later, we find them at universities, occupying specially designated chairs, for example at Bologna, where the sources mention no less than 3 professors of astrology at the end of the 15th century. Finally, they also appear in less prestigious settings when they give advice to ordinary townsfolk, as has been demonstrated by Sophie Page in her study of Richard Trevithian, who practiced in 15th century London. In order to realize how diverse and widespread the astrologer's public and clientele must have been, it suffices to have a look at the publication history of Judicia Anni, Yearly Prognostications, that constitute a sort of astrological pulp literature, but that figure quite prominently amongst the earliest texts that have been printed in considerable numbers from the 1470s on. All these observations, that could easily be multiplied and complemented, attest to the importance of astrologers in the late Middle Ages and beyond. What I am interested in now is to get a better idea of the parameters of their role. What did their activities look like? How influential were they in reality? But most importantly, how did they succeed to establish themselves as scientific experts who were not only listened to, but effectively paid for their advice? These kinds of questions are indeed worth being asked for a multitude of reasons that I cannot outline in detail here. Not least among them, and we can pick this up in more detail in the discussion, is the fact that the example of astrologers as experts in the late Middle Ages lends itself to develop a comparative perspective to modern phenomena of expertise that claims, to hold insight into the future. Let's say, for example, by financial and economic experts. My focus is thus on astrologers as experts and scientific advisors, and I am well aware that every noun in this description would merit further qualification and is not without problems. Obviously, the fine but quite fundamental distinctions we make today between astrologers and astronomers does not apply to the period I'm dealing with. However, since the services my protagonists provide largely include quite specific prognostications and interpretations that go well beyond the realm of astronomical observations, I will consistently call them astrologers, even if their work is inevitably based on their empirical observations or on calculations. As to the notions of expert in science, many historians of science would vividly accuse me to apply entirely anachronistic notions to a pre-modern setting and thus to risk to construct a more or less inadequate image. Not only was the notion of expert in the modern sense unknown before the 16th century, but in addition, the practices of pre-modern scholars certainly differed from what we call science today. Of course, this criticism and caveats are justified. At the same time, I would like to underline that social and cultural phenomena may well exist for which the cultures and societies in question do not have developed a precise vocabulary. Even more, they may even be entirely unaware of the existence of these phenomena, which is the whole point of what we call social sciences. Avoiding anachronistic terms that might serve as heuristic tools entirely, just because they are not part of the vocabulary of the society we analyze, thus seems to risk a quite unfertile scientific fundamentalism that somewhat misunderstands what social sciences, and I consider history to be at least partly one of them, are all about. So let's get back to astrologers as experts and scientific advisors in the late Middle Ages. In my current research, I'm interested in the specific historical configuration in the broadest sense. I thus ask who those astrologers were, what qualified them to give advice, in an absolute sense, but also in the eyes of their clients, how they managed to acquire sometimes lucrative positions, close to powerful princes who were willing to lend them their ear and to follow their advice. I'm interested in how they were perceived by their clients and what they actually had to offer from an analytic point of view. Of course, they told their clients what the future held in store for them, but perhaps their expertise and activity had additional value besides their prognostication about the future. Finally, I also tried to collect material about the importance of performance. How did these astrologers act? How did they speak? How did they dress in order to be recognized and accepted as serious practitioners of their science? Unfortunately, this last set of questions is particularly hard to answer, since the sources which give us a certain idea are frustratingly scarce. But as I already said today, I want to focus on one specific question that I consider to be particularly important and revealing. In the following minutes, I will thus neither continue this general outline of my research nor present a classical case study. Instead, I will try to develop something a little bit unusual for an historian, perhaps. I will try to develop an argument that finally shows how my initial question might well be justified, but nevertheless misleading and inappropriate. So let us get closer to this question by outlining some basic observations. In the late Middle Ages, as I have already mentioned, we find an impressive number of astrologers in contexts that we might describe, in modern analytical terms, as highly politic and close to the centers of power. Amongst these, courtly settings are particularly present and well documented. From the 13th century onwards, and with a considerable increase in the 14th and 15th centuries, we find numerous astrologers at princely courts, and these astrologers can by no means be adequately described as charlatans, like medieval historians have done for far too long. They are not frauds who make a living by exploiting the gullibility and superstitious attitude of their clients. Quite on the contrary, my astrologers, if I may say so, are usually quite highly qualified and well-trained. Many of them formally graduated in universities and practiced as physicians. Mathematicians are rather rare in courtly settings, who inevitably needed astrological knowledge and expertise in order to effectively perform their art. Sources that demonstrate how important contemporary physicians considered astrology to be are quite numerous, and recent research has further stressed this intimate link, for example, in a volume co-edited by Anna Akasoy, Charles Burnett, and Ronit Yoelit-Glalin. One of the many witnesses, and this really, these slides I brought you, they merely serve as illustrations to give you something for the eye rather than a basis for my argument. One of the many witnesses for the presence of the idea in the late Middle Ages is Agostino da Trento, who repeatedly underlined this in his writings in the middle of the 14th century, and whose opinion is confirmed by Hartmann Schedel over one century later. So this is an autograph copy of the text by Agostino da Trento, and in this autograph copy, Hartmann Schedel well underlined with a pointing finger, this is the utilitas huius opusculi, so this is the usefulness of this little word. In addition to their academic background, the astrologers I'm interested in possess further abilities or capabilities. They are well trained as empirical observers of celestial phenomena, the regularities of which they can mathematically grasp and describe. Based on this empirical basis, which becomes the foundation for the ensuing methodological treatment and interpretation that is based on a corpus of theoretical knowledge, they can then provide insight into present and future phenomena on Earth. At least they claim they can. Thus, they provide knowledge to their clients, whom they counsel against a certain reward. To put a long story short, they act as paid experts. And as I already said, these experts are still underrated in modern medieval history, even though they played a vital role as scientific political advisors in a multitude of contexts. They were listened to and they were paid for their service. At the same time, they are systematically underrepresented in our sources for a number of reasons, including the traditional orientation of authors of historiographical texts. Nevertheless, the number of texts that still attest to the astrologers' activities remains impressive, and the systematic underrepresentation allows us to conclude that their real presence and importance must have been even higher. If needs be, we can of course come back to this basic, to these basic traits of the of this brief outline of the situation in a discussion. For the sake of the argument, I will just treat it as a given for the moment. This leads, however, to a pestering and vexing question. My basic assumption is that the prognostication of future events, with the obvious exception of strictly stellar phenomena like solar or lunar eclipses, etc. So the prognostication of future events on the basis of astrological procedures is simply impossible, because the underlying empirical basis is not connected in a causal relation with the effects that are supposed to ensue. At least, we cannot substantiate such a causal connection. Now, this means, however, that my astrologers must inevitably have been wrong, quite frequently, whenever they offered prognostications that went beyond mere generalities. And indeed, they did provide this kind of predictions, which is not very surprising, since their clients, their paying clients, I should underline, asked them quite specific questions. Should I marry this woman, or rather another one? Or should I not marry at all? Should I go to war tomorrow, or rather the day after? When should I start my journey to the Holy Sepulchre? Where should I build a city? These precise questions with which astrologers were confronted provided an important incentive to give equally precise answers if the experts wanted to uphold their relevance and their status as competent advisors. Now, one might object that this outline of the situation constitutes yet another anachronistic projection of modern reasoning on a late medieval situation. But even though this objection must be taken seriously, I believe it can be qualified, at least with a brief glimpse at Simon de Fa's famous Recueil des Célèbres Astrologues, written at the end of the 15th century. This impressive and voluminous work basically gives a long list of successful, albeit often purely imaginary, practitioners of astrology, from the creation to Simon's own time. According to the author, the protagonists of his story were indeed held in high esteem by their contemporaries because they had successfully predicted specific events. So the argument is already there. The motive of successful predictions appears over and over again in this text, thereby demonstrating its presence and importance. But even if this wasn't the case, we could still hypothesize that astrologers must have frequently presented erroneous prognostications. But if this was the case, we have to ask how we can explain these constantly failing experts' persistent presence at European courts in the late Middle Ages and far into the early modern period. We do know of an impressive number of cases in which astrologers lived and worked in close proximity to the powerful, who listened to them, paid them, and in all probability let them thus influence their decisions, at least partly. Of course, this striking presence is somewhat counterbalanced by an equally impressive tradition of taunting and ridiculing. In chronicles and literary works alike, we find the motive of the ridiculous imposter astrologer over and over again. A huge number of authors obviously loved to make fun of these astrologers, but also of their clients, by presenting pertinent anecdotes. Some of them have already been collected by Theodor Wedel as early as in 1920 in his still helpful work on the medieval attitude towards astrology. As far as the ridiculed clients are concerned, for example, Wedel quoted Petrarca, who made fun of Galeazzo II Visconti's belief in astrology. Allegedly, Galeazzo had relied on his astrologer in order to choose the right moment to march against Pavia. When this moment had finally arrived, after a long time of waiting, heavy rain started to pour down and the entire campaign had to be cancelled. As far as the astrologers are concerned, I only want to mention the famous passage on the death of Necdanabo in the tradition of the medieval Alexander Romans. Several versions mention how Alexander had pushed the magician and astrologer Necdanabo into a pit. You can see this here. He's literally been overturned, where he left him to die. In addition, Alexander had sneeringly asked his victim why he had not been able to foresee his own end. Apparently, the medieval readers were quite impressed by this passage. At least several illustrators chose to represent the scene in their illustrations. In fact, even Simon de Phare conceded that astrologers notoriously had difficulties to correctly foresee their own end. Unfortunately, he did not develop this further, let alone give a systematic reason for this problem. So there was no lack of inimical derision, and the failure of predictions fueled the vivid criticism offered by adversaries of astrology that has repeatedly been published, especially by authors with a clerical background. But once again, how do we explain the apparent social success of these astrologers who failed over and over again? An adequate answer to this question, and this is doubtlessly a truism, cannot rely on a single reason. But to be more precise, I believe that we can only develop a convincing bundle of criteria if we try to mobilize the insights furnished by modern social sciences in order to analyze our problem. Based on pertinent studies of the quality and perception of modern prognostications or forecasts, we can in fact develop a perspective that ultimately nullifies the basic assumptions and foundations of my naive approach. On the basis of the studies by Philip Tetlock on the ex post evaluation of the quality of modern forecasts, but also on Joanna Hartelius' contributions on the role of rhetoric in the construction of expert roles, I want to use my remaining time in order to present, in all due brevity, a sort of casuistic framework of categorization and interpretation that I would like to discuss with you. A first category in this classificatory system relies on the critical interpretation of the prognostication's orientation. Usually, we assume that the information the astrologer's clients ask for are of value for these clients because they convey factual data that serve to take informed decisions. Just one well-known example in order to illustrate this. When the Roman-German king and soon-to-be Emperor Frederick III married the young Eleanor of Portugal in 1452, he apparently asked his astrologers to indicate a propitious moment for the consummation of this marriage in order to ensure that he fathered an auspicious son and successor. His astrologers, possibly Johannes Nihil, identified a conjunction of Sun and Venus as the best moment to ensure the desired outcome. And as far as we can see, the emperor actually tried to live up to this advice, even if it meant risking quite severe disharmony with his new family-in-law. I won't go into the details here, but I'm more than willing to tell you the entire story in the discussion. After all, it's just too nice, actually. Nevertheless, we shouldn't limit our interpretations to this entirely pragmatic approach, which takes the prognostications at face value as advice concerning future events. As has convincingly been demonstrated and argued by Georges Minois and Monica Azzolini, the consultation of astrologers might in fact have been considered to be valuable for quite different reasons. In the context of late medieval European court culture, the main arguments point into two directions. On the one hand, it is important to remember that astrologers did not only provide information about the future, but also referred to their own present. They could do so in a very explicit and outspoken way, for example, when they disclosed the location of stolen or lost objects, or even treasures. If we are to believe Jared Polley and Johann Dillinger, the late Middle Ages and the early modern period seem to have been quite obsessed with treasure hunting, and the idea that astrologers might point them into the right direction. Even more important, however, seems to be the fact that astrologers actually base their prognostications as a whole on a very careful survey of their own present. Of course, the prognostication as such presented itself nearly exclusively as being based on the interpretation of celestial constellations and stellar influence. This is, for example, the case in an astrological guidebook on health that Konrad Heingarter dedicated to Jean de la Goutte in 1469. In this text, which is today conserved at the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, the author explained Jean's predilection for voluptuous meals and the resulting physical consequences with celestial influence. In the hour of Jean's birth, the influence of Pisces and Aries combined, leading to a mixed complexion of phlegmatic and sanguine characteristics. And without this mixture, Jean would not suffer from, as the author put it, the abundance of fat in his body. But while the astrological reasoning provides an explanation, and the most comforting and comfortable one at that, the description of Jean's physical appearance is a result of simple empirical observations for which the expert provides appropriate reasons. We might call this fraud, but astrologers' preliminary surveys were valuable in their own right, since they assembled a set of careful observations. Ultimately, we have to assume that they might have provided the best foundation for decision-making that was on offer. While this argument stresses the real practical value of astrologers' advice on the basis of the actual content, we should by no means ignore the political and social effects and repercussions of the ostentatious consultation of experts. By including them in the process of his decision-making, a prince openly displayed his willingness to live up to an old ideal that was ceaselessly underlined in mirrors of princes and further political advice literature. Decisions were not to be taken alone and uncounseled, but only after the consultation of wise men. The widely circulating Secretum Secretorum, to name but one particularly pertinent example, quite explicitly stated that the prince should do nothing at all, should not do anything at all whenever possible, without the counsel of an experienced astrologer. Now, in spite of all the criticism astrologers were confronted with and that came from different directions, their activity provided the powerful with a means to stabilize their own rule and might. And at the same time, the astrologers' activity opened up new political options. If we look at the general development of princely councils from the high to the late Middle Ages, we can see a slow but steady transformation from an instrument of the much-cited consensual rule into a functional and specialized advisory body. As a clear indicator of this development, one might refer to the constantly growing presence and influence of jurists in this context. In the social patchwork of the incessantly evolving courts, astrologers introduced themselves as a new component, which at once provided the ruler with new and broader political options, because their presence led to new competition amongst the advisors. This effect has been demonstrated by John Cabot quite some time ago for the court of Charles V of France. Cabot could convincingly demonstrate how the various versions of Nicolas Rhem's criticism of astrology can actually be explained with these mechanisms of rivalry and competition. In addition, Simon de Fer himself provides us with a quite explicit piece of evidence, even if he argues for his own discipline, when he underlines that princes did well to listen to their astrologers who applied the rules of science and not the illiterate, ignorant and asses to whom they unfortunately lend their ear so often. These brief comments should suffice to outline the first broad category, which is primordially based on arguments concerning the worth of astrologers' activities as producing valuable service of the present and the diverse effects of ostentatious counseling. A second category that I consider to be at least as important as the first should, however, not be forgotten. And this category relies much more heavily on recent studies and insight that have been produced by research in the social sciences on the role of prognostications and forecasts. Before I proceed, I just want to remind you that I'm not concerned with a general theory on the role and function of prognostications, but that I merely try to explain why my erroneous astrologers have been so impressively successful for such a long time. In order to answer this question, it seems to me that we first have to ask, and this leads to a first subcategory, if the error they make has in fact even been consciously perceived as such. This might seem quite trivial, but we have to remember that the conscious knowledge that an error had been made is the indispensable basis for this error to have practical consequences. What are then the observations we can make when it comes to my astrologers? First of all, I have to mention the surprising fact that documented cases beyond the realm of the anecdotal are astonishingly rare. Seen from a critical perspective and with modern hindsight, we can nevertheless identify a certain number of predictions that were just plain wrong. One quite explicit example has recently been mentioned by Stefan Heilen in an article on astrology at the court of Urbino. Paul of Middelburg, one of the most famous and ambitious practitioners of his art, had predicted in his prognostication for 1482 that the solar eclipse that was to take place on May 17th, 1482, and actually that's, I just couldn't resist, so this is the cause of the eclipse. So he was right in calculating the date, but actually you couldn't see this eclipse or witness this eclipse in Italy at this time. But nevertheless, there was a solar eclipse on this date. And this eclipse, he said, would be dangerous for Duke Federico's health, but that the Duke would survive its effects if he received appropriate medical treatment. Unfortunately for Paul, who also acted as the Duke's physician, Federico died in September. Heilen underlines in his analysis that this, I quote, must have been embarrassing for Paul, end quote. But apparently the failure had no further consequences for his career, and this is really astonishing. Thus we have to ask if Paul's contemporaries were even aware that his text contained this serious flaw. The question of perception and awareness becomes even more acute if we consider that most of the time astrologers were wise enough to avoid precise predictions anyway. In fact, it seems that the ability to remain appropriately general and vague was one of the key competences of these experts, just like many of their modern colleagues. Unfortunately, we do not dispose of any kind of manual that would explicitly address this dimension of the astrologer's practical activities in counseling. But we can at least have a glimpse at how their work in practice was perceived through the detailed and outspoken criticism by Nicolas Rem, who proves to be a fine observer with an eye for psychological effects. Of course, we have to be careful when we interpret his negative depiction of this fraudulent, I just put the, for your amusement, this description of how he tells astrologers proceed on this slide. His negative depiction of these fraudulent charlatans against whom Orem harbors quite inimical feelings. But without entering the details of his argument, we can safely state that Orem accused them of either presenting only ambivalent and vague predictions, which enabled them to claim that they had told the truth no matter what happened exactly, or using background knowledge that they obtained from sources of non-astrological nature. In the latter case, so Orem's reasoning goes, they could considerably increase their chances to predict correctly, but these prognostications didn't have anything to do with astrology. One might compare this with the modern phenomenon of insider trading. Now, while we can't explain away the second phenomenon, it must be underlined that the first variety of Orem's criticism is actually somewhat unfair. After all, it was the official position of the Church, which actually concurs with astrological authorities like Ptolemy in this regard, that the observation of the stars only allowed for general predictions in a legitimate way. Specific predictions that concerned individual human actions, on the other hand, were considered to be neither possible nor legitimate. Concerning my own modest question, this means, however, that the number of prognostications that could potentially be perceived as having been correct could have increased quite considerably, at least far beyond the number of statistically expectable random hits. This effect depended, of course, on the degree of acceptance on the client's part, whether they were content to receive these general prognostications or asked for more specific details. Now, a second aspect that should not be neglected is also connected with the question of perception, but it has more to do with fundamental traits of human cognitive psychology. As has been underlined by Philip Tetlock, but analogous considerations equally play a role in Jens Beckert's most recent monograph on imagined futures, humans show a considerable tendency to ignore yesterday's prognostications. As a consequence, we apply a sort of systematic filter of negative perception that makes us forget erroneous predictions. We are just no longer interested in what has been said yesterday about the things that did not happen earlier today. In addition to the resulting consequences of active interest or its lack, the human brain and memory also have a confirmation bias. they constantly validate and update their content on the basis of the varying parameters of our changing environment. While our memory incessantly does this kind of work without us even noticing, it disproportionately focuses on elements that can be confirmed rather than on inconsistencies or even information that has been proven wrong after the fact and that thus has become irrelevant for the immediate present. Now, what do these well-proven effects mean for us? Basically, they imply that past statements about a future that failed to materialize afterwards will inevitably be less prominently noticed and remembered than statements, that is, predictions, that have been confirmed. Just compare these two predictions contained in the works of Pierre Bailly, who allegedly predicted the advent of Antichrist for 1789, which is quite spectacular, but other things just didn't arrive, which is much less spectacular and thus less frequently cited in modern literature, of any kind, by the way. Now, beyond this core's function that might be summarized as remembering or forgetting, an especially important side effect of our brain's confirmation bias consists in a detectable inclination to interpret past predictions as being at least partly true, whenever the data allows for this kind of interpretation. An impressive example for this reaction that can often be witnessed when experts are confronted with criticism of erroneous predictions can actually be found in late medieval material. Dr. Erhard Storch, a graduated physician and cleric at Chur, had published a so-called Judicium Anni for 1478 in the cathedral town by nailing the text to the cathedral's door. In his prognostication, which has not been preserved in the original, he apparently had quite explicitly predicted the demise of either the Pope, that is Sixtus IV, or the Emperor Frederick III, or possibly both. This kind of prediction is not only unusually precise, because verifiable, but also quite bold, because the author risked to make some serious enemies. Unfortunately, we don't know enough about Dr. Storch's situation in order to explain this bold action. What we do know, however, is that at least one reader actually did remember the prediction that had proven erroneous after the fact. The provost of the cathedral church at Chur requested explicitly that Storch explained why his prognostication had failed to come true, or, in other words, why he had been wrong. The very fact that the astrologer has been explicitly confronted with his shortcomings is actually quite extraordinary, at least in the sources I have scrutinized so far. Analogous cases do not abound. But what is really interesting is Storch's reaction, and we only know about this because the entire affair has been recorded by Johannes Knebel at Basel in his diarium. First of all, Storch underlined the bad quality of the data that he had at his disposition and with which he had to work. Neither the Pope's nor the Emperor's exact time of birth had been known to him, so he had to make do with imprecise information and the ensuing results. But nevertheless, so he claimed immediately afterwards, his work had in fact produced viable results because both protagonists had fallen very ill and they very nearly had died. So instead of accepting his failure, the astrologer claimed that his method actually worked and would have produced entirely correct results, since in fact the results had already been partially correct, had it not been for the lack of precise information. In modern science, the underlying effect is known as trash in, trash out. The algorithm works, but you use bad data, you get bad results. It is interesting to see how modern experts frequently react the very same way as has been shown in a quite entertaining work on particularly prominent cases from the 20th and 21st century. Dan Gardner published under the nice title Future Babel, so that's really entertaining, really. I at least enjoyed it. In fact, the analogies between late medieval astrologers and modern experts can even be pursued further, because in addition to the claim that has been made by Storch, astrologers also defended themselves with an argument that still plays an important role today. They referred to the fact that their prognostications and their clients' knowledge about what was going to happen inevitably influenced the outcome. Based on this idea, we can find astrologers who claim that the events would doubtlessly have developed as they had predicted, had the protagonists not known about their predictions and the events that were about to happen. It is, of course, hardly astonishing that they should have used this argument. After all, it's just a flip side of the idea that foreknowledge allowed for preparation, a motive that was frequently used in order to explain the usefulness of astrology. And finally, there was the most potent and least disputable argument of all that astrologers frequently refer to in order to underline their religious orthodoxy. The Almighty God could obviously change the course of things whenever it pleased him. But in addition to the confirmation bias and its accompanying side effects, another phenomenon seems to be particularly important for my question, namely the human brain's predilection for arguments. As has been shown in a series of studies in the social and behavioral sciences since the 1970s, we are easily impressed with the presence of an argument, even if this argument doesn't have anything to do with the problem in question. This can be nicely illustrated with a concrete experimental constellation. Imagine you're working in a library and you want to make some photocopies of an article. Now, while you're walking up to the photocopier, to the Xerox machine, somebody else comes along, and even though you arrive first, this other person wants to use the machine before you. Now, three options have been tested. First, the other person comes along and asks, "Can I go first?" It is not excluded that this version leads to success, but chances are, in fact, quite slim. In the second version, the other person comes along and asks, "Can I go first? I'm in a terrible hurry. My class starts in a moment and I forgot to prepare the handouts." And this strategy, you might all, it won't come as a surprise to you, this strategy dramatically increases the success rate. People are actually quite cooperative, and many of the test persons did indeed let the other person go first. Now, the third variety, the other person comes along and asks, "Can I go first? I have to make some copies." Now, believe it or not, this also dramatically increases the success rate, even though a little less than the second version. You have, of course, noticed that the alleged argument, in fact, is none, because everybody who wants to use a photocopier wants to make photocopies, so there's nothing argumentative about the argument. Nevertheless, the sheer presence of something that looks like an argument at first glance does make a difference. Now, how does this relate to my subject? What I have been describing does in fact apply generally to moments of communication and social interaction. However, the insight can be made fertile in order to explain the success of astrologers as counselors too, as has been shown in the context of belief in astrology in contemporary France by sociologist Arnaud Esquer a few years ago. In the case of astrological predictions about the future, the fact that the prognostications are actually provided not only with an argument, but even with an argument that relies on an entire system of rules and interpretative descriptions, does go a long way in increasing people's belief in these forecasts. What has not yet been systematically analyzed, as far as I can see, is the influence of the use of numbers. My hypothesis would be that the very fact that astrologers, just like modern economists and statisticians, express their findings in numbers and mathematical formulae further adds to their credibility in their clients' eyes. Finally, and this should not be neglected either, the explicit and individual calculation of a horoscope or of any other sort of astrological judgment leads the consumers to perceive this forecast as being particularly trustworthy. And this effect would thus mark the difference between, let's say, bespoke expertise and the generic short horoscopes one can find in nearly every journal and magazine, and that give advice for all the people born under one sign of the zodiac. If we consider all these observations, we can not only explain my medieval astrologer's success much better, but we are actively preparing the keys to open further insights into the concrete workings of their activity. And this better understanding is, of course, not limited to the astrologers, but also to their clients, because the construction of a social role, in my case, the astrology, astrologically informed expert advisor always works in the dynamics of interaction. Now, this having been said, what are the consequences for my own modest question? Why could astrologers acquire and maintain their position as experts for so long, even if they were doomed to fail incessantly? On the basis of my short categorization, it seems to me that this question might be answered in three ways. First of all, it seems obvious that it was not entirely about what astrologers predicted about the future. Consulting an astrologer could have a broad set of beneficial political consequences for a prince. In addition, astrologers were acute observers and could provide surveys of their present that had their own value. It is interesting and noteworthy that the question I have raised has in fact already been recognized by medieval authors. This demonstrates the validity of my assumption that we have to do with a culture of expertise. It also demonstrates that the question I ask concerning the effects of failing prognostications is not just an anachronistic projection from a modern perspective, but has already been raised, at least implicitly, by late medieval authors. Secondly, we have seen that in order to have consequences, failure must first be perceived as such. And as I hope to have shown, astrologers, just like modern experts, could in fact profit from some of the peculiarities of the human brain and the mechanisms of human memory in order to make their failures go unnoticed. Third, and finally, this implies that my initial question does in fact perhaps not even apply after all, which invites us to rephrase the entire problematic. While my question might be viable from a historical perspective, insight from the social and behavioral sciences forces us to rethink its assumptions quite radically. What are the consequences of this short overview on a difficult inquiry that seeks to combine approaches which are well established in cultural history with insights from the social sciences? First of all, I think that my argument demonstrates the fertility and necessity of sincere interdisciplinary cooperation. While my first conclusion concerning the multiple uses and advantages of astrological counseling could certainly be reached by applying approaches cultural history is familiar with, this does not hold true for the second one. If we want to propose adequate and probable explanations of phenomena that are profoundly connected with the mechanisms of human perception and memory, we are well advised to enter a dialogue with the relevant disciplines. But doing so does, of course, raise the question if these disciplines' findings can be applied to other periods and cultures than those that furnished the test groups. While I would agree that there can be no general answer to this question, it seems to me that specific questions can be answered more adequately and more precisely by proceeding this way. In fact, the solution for the problem I wanted to share with you today would be practically out of reach if we ignored the insights modern science have to offer, modern sciences have to offer us. And the real beauty of it is, it works both ways. If we can indeed apply findings from the social and behavioral sciences to medieval context, we might also use the medieval data in order to better understand modern mechanisms. As you are doubtlessly aware, we all rely on the advice of experts who provide detailed prognostications about the future and who regularly fail and dramatically fail. In the case of late medieval astrologers, historians have frequently argued that their presence demonstrates late medieval princes' superstitious character. Now the question is, what does this imply for the way we depict ourselves in contemporary Western societies? This is of course another story I will leave to our discussions, but I couldn't refrain from giving you the statistics and this wonderful quote from quite late in 2007. As you all know, the financial crisis of 2007 already had shown the most severe consequences for the month of September. And these are the numbers for the forecast of the White House Council of Economic Advisers. These are the real numbers that developed afterwards. And it's just too beautiful to rethink the role and status of modern experts on the background of medieval expertise, which works as a system of belief, and my hunch would be that we would be well advised to interpret modern expertise and our use and reliance on modern expertise much more as a system of belief